Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke, and this week I get to relive more great Survivor Series memories, such as Shawn Michaels' bleeding heroics, Brock Lesnar's feat of strength, and Triple H being dropped 40 feet. Survivor Series hadn't seen a nosedive like that since Tully Blanchard back in 89.
I'm G. John Chase, and tonight I'm going to be wearing a pair of snakeskin trousers, just like Undertaker at Survivor Series 2000. They're not replicas, they are actually his trousers. They cost about $2.99, and most of that was postage and packaging.
I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and I'm thankful that my Wolverhampton Wanderers gave a shellacking to Carl Jones's Birmingham City last weekend. I'm also thankful that Sasha Banks has finally agreed to meet with me after the Manchester show next Monday. Thank you.
And I'm Carl Jones, and thanks to a gagging order coming out of the state of Pennsylvania, I will refrain from making jokes or remarking on the murder trial of one Jimmy Snuka this week. I won't at all possibly comment that I feel that he did it, and I will refrain from making any jokes about naked running down hallways and being tasered by police.
This is the panel for the 60th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about Survivor Series from 2000 to 2014 next. Hello everyone and welcome to the 60th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
Bonjour.
Carl Jones.
Again, I won't comment on Jimmy Snuka killing Nancy Argentina.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Again, 2-0 Carl, suck it.
Tosser.
And we are back this week for part two of our series looking at the history of the Survivor Series pay-per-view. Last week we covered 1987 to 1999 in the history of the Survivor Series as we were talking about the struggle for relevance and identity. We're looking at the second half of the show's existence today, and I think that a lot of the things that we mentioned last week that we saw signs of are going to bear fruit in this show. So it's going to be a very interesting journey, and I should add, just like last week, you of course have your fondest Survivor Series memories from this batch of shows that we're going to talk about throughout the course of the show. With that said, before we actually proceed with every Survivor Series from 2000 onwards, just a quick programming note for next week. Obviously, this series will be wrapped up, so we will be doing a show based on Jump the Shark moments in wrestling history. Your Jump the Shark moments. We're going to leave this one out to you in terms of how vague or liberal you want to be, whether it's a moment in a promotion's history that just turned you off, whether it's a moment that's very well known as a Jump the Shark moment that turned off wrestling fans that you know. Anything of that nature. We're going to talk about all the classic Jump the Shark moments in wrestling history next week on the show, and you can leave your feedback with us on the Facebook page. Like us on Facebook and drop your feedback off there at facebook.com/scgradio. Obviously, we mentioned before, we did part one last week. You can go back and listen to that in the archives at squaredcirclegazette.com. And where we left off, 1998 was a Survivor Series show where they'd blown up the formula, they did the tournament, and I got rave reviews. The year afterwards, 1999, not so much, as they kind of were in that kind of middle hazy period. A lot of bleed over from 1999 to 2000, as far as I see here, and kind of get you guys' thoughts around the table on the 2000 edition of the Survivor Series, because similar to 99, the Survivor Series matches in there, but they really don't seem to serve much of a purpose other than just to kind of be holdovers of the old Survivor Series tradition. Harmonic Generator from the UK Fan Forum says, on the subject of the 2000 Survivor Series, great roster, unmemorable show. I have vague memories of the TNA match, the DX match, and the RTC match, and for some reason I really remember liking Undertaker versus Angle, but mostly I remember being amazed at and then hating the ending. Austin just dropped Triple H in a car from a fucking crane. What went through my young mind as I rewound it again and again was, how could he even survive that? Followed by, are people supposed to like Austin? He just tried to kill Triple H. Today, I suspect Triple H may not, in fact, have been in the car. So we can't get one past Harmonic Generator there, but thoughts around the table on this edition of the Survivor Series, because a very interesting one, just in the sense of this was, in the middle of a great pay-per-view year, one of the real kind of duds as far as I see.
Quite frankly, the matches with Rock and Rikishi and Austin Triple H, Angle Undertaker just did not interest me at all, and kind of watching these back, particularly with these three matches, the Rock Rikishi's just like a non-entity. Just like we talked before about how much of a misstep Rikishi's heel turn was, and just it didn't make any sense. And to be honest, this match wasn't up to much. The Austin Triple H, it's when you get to that ending, which, as the writer states, it's absolutely befuddling. It's just like it's usually one of those overblown spots that they always do outside, like I'm thinking of Vince's exploding limousine and stuff like that, where you can kind of tell like what the TV production was in that, and you know how they went about it. It wasn't just the fact that Triple H gets lifted up on a freaking forklift and then dropped. It's just the fact that he just kind of looks and just kind of goes, Yeah, and just walks off. It's just kind of, you're just watching it. And that's how it ends. It's like, I don't even think there was necessarily anything from JR, if I remember right. Well, there you go.
The end.
A death.
The lunacy of the spot notwithstanding, that's the exact sort of reaction Steve Austin should have as a character.
To killing someone.
Well, it doesn't...
It was revenge maybe, for a vehicular hire.
Maybe he knew he wasn't dead. Mm-hmm. Damn it, that's not going to kill Triple H.
No, no. Oh, he's going to be back in 2 weeks.
God damn it.
Nary a scratch on him,
I should have set fire to it.
Now, be fair, Liam. 3 weeks.
Oh, my mistake. I am interested, though, because to me, this is a... Yeah, as you mentioned there, G, some of these matches didn't really interest you. The Undertaker wearing a stunning pair of trousers.
Yeah.
In a match with Kurt Angle, which didn't really interest me in the build-up. And this is that thing of Rikishi, Rock, Austin Triple H is based around an angle that I thought was a real kind of dreck moment for the WWF in 2000, where it's like, this is going in a direction I don't particularly like. And this paper you didn't draw very well.
Oh, surprise.
Well, I think it is a surprise in the sense that in
just
theory,
on paper, yeah, in theory, on paper, Steve Austin going for revenge against the guy who masterminded the hit and run. To me, that seems like very obvious money, but it didn't do it for the audience. They didn't buy.
It almost feels like I'm blaming Rikishi entirely for this, which probably isn't fair. But so the way that he is intertwined in that storyline to me makes it almost come off as second rate, because Rikishi had no involvement really in the top of the card in the build up to that. The month before his match with Austin at No Mercy, he's wrestling Eddie Guerrero Unforgiven and losing. Winning by DQ. Either way, it's a schmoz finish, and he's wrestling for the IC title. So it's almost that jump out of nowhere that doesn't really help. To your point about the show as a whole, Liam, it's very much based around the Austin Triple H match as a promotion for the show. Speaking to that point of the way that these Survivor Series matches are just sort of thrown out there, you look at the one heel team where it's Edge and Christian teaming with RTC members, the Good Father and Bull Buchanan, which, strange bedfellows and all that.
Well, it's just tag teams in a Survivor's match, isn't it?
It is.
A far cry from 87 and 88.
Kane and Jericho, which is the opening match to their feud that would run for sort of a couple of month period.
Kane goes over here with a chokeslam clean, if I recall.
Yeah. He does indeed. As infuriating as it is, at least Jericho gets a bit of heat back later in the show, and then he ultimately wins the blow off. So I can accept that at least.
By the way, you're looking extra Kane-ish today with your haircut.
Oh, go fuck yourself.
Another loss for Carl.
What about match two, Carl?
Oh, what, such illustrious people as Billy Gunn, Road...
be correct, the one Billy
the
Gunn.
The one Billy Gunn. A clearly drugged up Road Dogg in dungarees.
Yeah.
K Quick and China.
Yeah.
I will say, it's an absolute abomination that, if I'm not mistaken, in that match against the reformed Radicals, that Eddie Guerrero is the first man eliminated.
He is. I think China's the first person eliminated, but the rat. But
thing.
Guerrero, I should say that, sorry. China's the first man eliminated. And then Guerrero goes shortly after.
It's still a travesty.
Yeah.
I'm just looking back now, Benoit and Saturn. So like, why Saturn?
Yeah. See, why not?
Eddie? Was Eddie doing the Mamacita stuff?
They had the falling out, obviously.
Fall out of it.
I still don't see that as justification for
why
he can't win. But
just trying to...
Fantastic German suplex on Benoit and K-Quick on the show, where he almost just absolutely just... I've got to choose my words carefully here, but he destroys him, let's put it that way.
Well, I can't remember the build for Austin and Triple H, but the fact that he drew so low is mind-boggling. I mean, it's
the prime era. Austin just come back.
It's just like a domino effect. Like, first they reveal it's Rikishi, which no one kind of bought into. Of all the characters, I mean, Rikishi, in all fairness, during 2000 was pretty over as a babyface, a mid-card babyface. And so it was like, really? That's how you're going to progress this guy? I mean, like, I don't necessarily think he was ever going to be like a main eventer, but he was obviously an act that was working well. So he'd be like almost the last person outside of Scotty Too Hotty that I would have chosen to do this role.
You put the finger at the Rikishi and Austin running over angle, but Rikishi's in the middle of the card here.
Yeah.
But what's more important is he's in the middle of the card of The Rock. So is this an indication by this point that Rock was more significant to ratings than Austin and people just not interested in this match for Rock? Maybe, after X7, the reason for the decline wasn't that Austin turned, it was because Rock lost again to Austin.
Well, 2000 obviously was Rock's year, and it was the whole company was built around him as the face. They felt that they had to try and rectify it. So they just thought, like,
Triple H just wanted to weasel his way into the top spot again.
Yeah, obviously. So it just, it ended up just being with Triple H, which is just this, it's just tenuous links, isn't it? It's Austin Triple H, where it seems like the storyline wasn't prepared months in advance. They're just throwing it in now.
Well, in fairness, you could argue the case that it wasn't prepared months in advance, because they were just coming from the fallout of Triple H's aborted face turn that teased it all the way up to, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before the Survivor Series show.
And then it's revealed the guy with the black glove was actually
Triple H.
Yeah.
So it has that sense of, you know, and I think people at that point were probably ready for a Triple H face run. I think coming off the angle Stephanie thing, they were at least intrigued and would have give it, you know, maybe it wouldn't have worked out so well in the end perhaps, but fans were ready to give it a go at that point.
Yeah, and this is the real first time where Stephanie gets her fingerprints on the booking team as well. And Rikishi was her first big call, and this was her first major pay per view where she had more hands on role.
It's just such a waste of a storyline.
Moving along now, since that was a show where the Survivor Series itself, not to say it wasn't necessarily a relevant show, because obviously they thought Austin Triple H was going to be a big deal, and they focused on that. But again, the Survivor Series match, the original concept, has fallen by the wayside. Very much the same here in 2001, although the main event of this show does lead to a natural blow-off in ways that other Survivor Series shows didn't. 2001, of course, DCW from the UK fan forum, for his fondest memory, said, "I love the WWF versus Team Alliance in 2001, and the rest of the card was pretty decent too, if I recall. Test and Edge had a cracking unification match, plus it was Heyman's proper last night on commentary, and he was in excellent form. Crowbro from F4W says, 2001 felt so important at the time. In hindsight, as bad as the invasion was, I was so into it, and it felt like that night, that match was going to be a tipping point for the company, and I guess it was. The Raw the next night is one of my favourite Raws ever, even with the inexplicable Austin angle double turn." Spike from Wrestling Form also says this one: "Whatever you think of the invasion angle, that match was huge and the culmination of one of the biggest storylines in pro wrestling history, and it was well done." Niall Clark left his thoughts on the Facebook page and said, "2001 featured Team WWF versus Team Alliance, which I loved. I remember as a kid rooting for the WWF, but ultimately being pissed off at the end at the sight of Vince." which we'll get to that in a second. Harmonic Generator from the UK Fan Forum is back in and says, "As a WWF only WCW ignorant viewer, I enjoyed the invasion and I wanted to see how it would end. My main memory, however, is this video package which played before the main event. Don't know who WWE had working on their packages at the time, but they earned every penny of whatever they got paid. That video is just glorious. I love it. Watch that video and tell me you didn't get the feels." Ramstein Mad from TPWW: "The winner take all match from 2001. It wasn't so much a special moment, but the match itself was just brilliant. Had high stakes, lots of great spots, twists and turns, just a really good match. Even the fact that the Alliance was made up of three WWF guys didn't bother me, as it really was pretty much our 10 biggest stars in one match. Except Shane, who probably should have been replaced with DDP or someone, but at that point in time I can understand why Shane, and it worked well within the match." And wrapping this up, Loss from Pro Wrestling Only says, "I like the WWE versus Alliance match at Survivor Series, even though the booking going in was what it was. It was cool seeing Jericho at the end with Austin and Rock being portrayed as being as close to their equal as the storyline would allow. Edge Test on the undercard I remember being shockingly good too, but I haven't seen it in years." Broach the subject of this, because I was actually surprised how much positive feedback this show got. As a standalone match, I can see people enjoying it, but even then, I don't think this is the best Survivor Series match we're going to get to during this period. I don't think it's actually that close either.
Hello.
I've got nothing against that match per se, but because of the way it's intertwined with the invasion angle and the way the invasion angle pretty much just fell off a cliff after that first pay-per-view, this match, unfortunately to me, it has that taint.
Mm.
And I
just can't get past the fact that the ultimate match to decide the fate of WCW and WWF comes down to Rock, Austin, Angle and Jericho at the end, you know?
And a Kurt Angle who turned heel, 3 weeks beforehand, having spent the entire summer feuding with Austin as well, and slapdash approach to it all. And the decision to go with this as a main event was only made probably, 4 weeks beforehand. It was very much a panicky reaction to the way that the ratings had declined somewhat and the pay-per-view buy rates had fallen in comparison to the same periods of previous year.
40-50 minute long match, and you know, all the twists and turns and stuff like that. But my recollection is that the crowd heat's not that great. It's good, but it's not like it's blow away the end of wrestling as we know it kind of level, you know?
Yeah, I kind of along the same lines as you. I mean, this was already spoiled. The milk was spoiled on this brew a long time ago. And as you say, like, Austin, Angle and Shane in this, whatever it is, the Alliance, just didn't do it for me going in, I think. And it was now finally put the puppy down kind of thing.
And I think to Liam's point in terms of the crowd heat for the match, I don't think they really get into it in truth until Jericho's eliminated.
And
it comes down,
Rock and Austin.
Comes down to Rock.
Which
and,
is where the match picks up for me, because the rest of the eliminations is just one after another, like a disheartening feeling, like, oh, Booker's gone early. Oh, Van Damme's gone. Oh, look at this. It's, you know, what's Big Show doing in there anyway? You know, it's like Big Show, you know, just coming off the Shoguns tag team, you know, is now being just bung-holed in this match.
I hated this show. Big fan of the Invasion show. By this point, I mean, I hated this show because it was ending. I was pissed off that it was ending because it should have lasted 2 years.
I agree.
It should have been a long ass storyline. I think I might have been probably one of the only few people that was actually rooting for WCW in this match, just to see something different from it, because it just seemed like, okay, we're gonna get the predictability of a WrestleMania, really.
Well, this is the thing, just not to cut you off, because I'm gonna go back straight to you, but I lost a tenner because I bet somebody at school that the Alliance was going to win, because I just couldn't fathom that they were going to end the angle this soon and without doing what I in my head figured is the obvious stuff you're going to do in an Invasion angle, such as bringing the WCW guys, which of course the next night they would do.
What bothered me about those final four, because it was obvious it was going to be Rock Austin at the end, the whole thing with Jericho Kurt, because it wasn't just the fact that Kurt turned back babyface, but it was also Jericho technically turned heel because he tried to screw the Rock over as well. So it was just like, it was too much complications in the match to try and give it that kind of roller coaster feel, when it was just like, if first off you just put better people in the match to start with, and you just did it like a typical Survivor Series matchup that led to the conclusion of, I don't want it to be Rock and Austin. I want it to be maybe Rock and Booker T. I don't know. It should have been.
But by then it was too late, I think. Yeah. I agree. Don't get me wrong. In principle, you're completely right. But I think, By the state that they got in at this point, I think it needed the twists and turns, because on its own, I don't think it was worth three squirts of piss.
And they need some stories coming out of the show.
Exactly.
So things like
the
Jericho turn, I can understand. Yeah, there was no plans to go forward with this. I just wondered, G, when you mentioned put better people in, looking at the roster at the time and the way things were, who would that have been? I'm just curious, because I really struggle with it. I don't disagree with the notion of, why is Shane McMahon there? Who are the better people to put in by the time you've got sort of this period, who would those better people have been?
No, you're absolutely right. You caught me out on that one, because just looking at the Alliance representatives on the show, and you're looking at Christian, William Regal, Test, the Dudley Boys, Test again, Austin, Kurt Angle, Shane McMahon, all WF guys. The only people who actually represent the Alliance is Booker T and Rob Van Dam, and technically Jazz, you know, so they bring in a female representative for the Alliance on the night that they're going.
Yeah. Ivory 2 was another turncoat that really set the world afire.
Yeah, but it's just, again, it's just like, in comparison to the Invasion, where we've debated about how shitty the Invasion was, but at least on that show, there was WCW wrestlers on the Alliance team. By this point, it's a WWF show with a WCW name, and poor Booker T and Rob Van Dam just getting jobbed out and not having any sort of real relevance in that final match. So it's like, you caught me out there, Carl, you're absolutely right.
Just to bring this back on track, though, for what the overall idea of this show is, talking about the relevance, I mean, at this point, I mean, the Survivor Series is the end of the biggest angle in wrestling history as it was supposed to be, or at least fantasized to be about for us wrestling fans. And they say the one big Survivor Series match for the end, for the final match, and this kind of goes back to what we were saying last week about the built-in irrelevance that Survivor Series in some ways has, in the sense that it was used not as a blow-off show, but it's kind of a stopgap for greater things that the company was doing at the time. Do you think that this kind of a format would work on a more regular basis, where obviously, in a sense, of Survivor Series is built up to be almost the War Games of WWE, if you will?
But in terms of booking, I mean, I understand why they go, because in order to build up to a big team-on-team feud blow-off, to do it properly, it's a lot of prep, and to do that year after year after year, it would become pretty repetitive pretty quickly.
Yeah.
In terms of longevity of that, I mean, that is the perfect goal of, you know, the War Games blow off to a few, but you've got to have the pieces in play and in place to do that to start with. And first of all, they're not, so you have to fabricate something.
Have the inherent problems you had with War Games, where they had to shoehorn people like the Shockmaster in.
Yeah, and the problem that you get with the company now, in the sense of if you're looking at these sort of arbitrary points on a calendar for that's when we're going to do this, as opposed to, you know, we'd like to build to this at some point further down the road, and we can be a bit more flexible with the time of year. When you pigeonhole yourself into sort of, you know, it's going to be November, I say you have the problems that you have now with pay-per-views such as Hell in a Cell, where they're feuds that aren't really befitting of a Hell in a Cell match. But
this year being the exception.
Yeah, this Roman Reigns and Wyatt, I think, is an exception because of how long it went, and obviously, you know, Lesnar take, you've got to escalate to something after what they've done at SummerSlam. But you know, you fall into that point of almost, oh crap, look at the date. Well, let's just throw him in there. Let's throw him in the cage.
Yeah, and plus, I mean, it's quite easy for you to integrate, say, four singles feuds to get into one match. You could do that quite easily.
Yeah.
But the fact is, that's done all year round anyway.
Yeah.
So for it to resonate more for Survivor Series, it's a bit of an ask. It's another multi-man match we get on Raw each week anyway.
Just going ahead a bit. In 2002, I thought they were going to do something similar with that with Elimination Chamber, where it looked like Elimination Chamber was going to be like a Survivor Series gimmick. And I was quite fond of that, because I thought, they can actually do something like that.
I'm just saying, the idea of Survivor Series, as was in 2001 here, the big blow-off was built to the team match at Survivor Series.
We've got to have the groups in place
to
do that. The horse. I mean, this year...
Dangerous Alliance.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's inherently there to do it. Mm. Kind of, we're going to get that into some degree this year with like the Wyatts, because that's it's a natural program to do. It's a natural reason to do that, Survivor Series. You need the teams in place, first of all, to do that, with the number of guys to do it as well, so...
I mean, we've gone sort of around the table here in terms of how, or sort of the lack of genuine significance that the elimination matches themselves have, and obviously we've seen them whittled down over the years and had shows where they weren't even on there at all. I think by the time you get to 2001, it's the only elimination match on the card. I think you can also make the case that it's the, well, arguably the first and last time that an actual elimination match has any real significance in terms of the blow-off of a feud.
We are moving on now to 2002. Gee, you mentioned before the Elimination Chamber. That is the show we're talking about here. And the most feedback in a positive manner for any Survivor Series we had over the course of this series comes for this show. Vash from F4W says, pretty much all of Survivor Series 2002. This may be my favourite Survivor Series ever. Great show. Libertine from the UK Fan Forum says, HBK again with his beautiful poo brown outfit from 2002. With HBK stitched on the butt by a Chinese 5-year-old while he was still wearing the outfit, combined with a pair of cowboy boots, you have one damn fine outfit.
And the bob. Don't forget the bob.
Oh, Tigerick from the UK Fan Forum says, my favourite memory is probably the 2002 Elimination Chamber. I know Michaels' gear made him look like a hobo, and he had hair like a lesbian who'd been caught in a car wash, but it's a fantastic match, and the outcome with Michaels overcoming the evil Triple H was something I was really into at the time, once I'd made it through their SummerSlam match and subsequent angle without dying of a stress-related heart attack. Number one WWF fan from the TPWW forums says, HBK winning the belt in 2002. I hated that he was treated like an old guy used to put over the next generation for most of that second run. He went 8 years as the best performer in the company, and should have gotten more of a legit run as a long-term champion running neck and neck with Cena during the time. Instead, it seemed like he was booked based on his age as opposed to his ability. It does make looking back on that one night all that much more special, though. Tom Campbell left his a Cadillac of a man left his comments on Facebook. Ahoy fellas, love the show. I love Survivor Series 2002 with the Lesnar Big Show match, even though Paul was going through his wonderful smart casual jeans phase and the suit that made him look like a turd with a tie, and the first Elimination Chamber match. Oh, and Scott Steiner dropping the F-bomb on live TV seconds into his debut, which
I love you Tom.
Which was amazing. Dominator from DPWW says, Shawn Michaels 2002 win of the World Heavyweight Championship in the first ever Elimination Chamber was an awesome match after the WWE title switch, which had seen Big Show, after Paul Heyman swerved Lesnar out of it, which is brilliant in and of itself, take the title. I honestly remember more of Sean's 1 month run than anything from Big Show's second run. Project Humanoid from F4W says, it's this one the best Survivor Series ever. Steiner's hot debut that would deflate completely at the Rumble, the first chamber match, a really fun three-way tag with the SmackDown 6, Lesnar's first loss, and a fun opener that I'll always remember for Rico standing on the top rope forever because Jeff Hardy missed his cue to trip him, and him eventually screaming, come on Jeff, goddammit! This was an era where they go the extra mile for pay-per-view was at the Garden, the 2000 Rumble, this show, and WrestleMania 20 in particular. Noid from TPWW says, Scott Steiner debuted at this show, and I had been fairly unprepared for what would happen. The roof blew off the place. You've touched on this segment before, but Matt Hardy version 1 was an interesting story for me. In Australia, Fox 8 had cancelled SmackDown temporarily, so all I could hear about was how awesome Matt Hardy was being. Seriously, there was a period of time where it felt like him and John Cena were the future of the company. All I really wanted as an Aussie fan was to be able to see Matt Hardy in the awesome SmackDown 6 matches, so this pay-per-view is a good window into seeing Hardy walking the line between charismatic enigma and dick heel. I didn't get Christopher Nowinski at the time, but I almost wish he had given up having a legitimate career in trying to better the lives of professional athletes in order just to see how good a wrestler he could have become. Paul Sebert from F4W says that this is a pretty fun card that people don't seem to talk about, featuring two great matches at the top. Los Guerreros taking on Angle and Benoit and Edge and Mysterio, and Michaels winning the title in the first ever Elimination Chamber, which was a great spectacle to see the first one. The card also saw an Elimination Tables match that was far better than it had any right to be, and in a rare highlight WWE Cruiserweight title bout, Noble vs. Kidman was tons of fun while it lasted. Plus, this was one of the only times where someone has successfully powerbombed Billy Kidman. On the downside, Lesnar vs. Show only lasted about 4 minutes and existed to set up Brock's face turn, though Heyman's promos on SmackDown leading up to this double turn were great. T. Lynch 106 from the FOW board says, I was at three of these Survivor Series shows. 2002 top to bottom is a great show, right down to the RNN news update. The night before the show, I waited in the freezing cold to meet Shawn Michaels with my buddies, and I wished him luck, to which he replied that he was nervous and unsure how many more matches he had left. He retired 8 years later. And finally, wrapping it up.
Still working, I'm Sean.
Cobra1000 from the UK fan forum says, any disappointment at the lack of traditional tag matches disappeared after we were given a new match concept and the promise of much bloodshed and brutality. I remember at the time being a huge RVD and Booker T fan, so I was pulling for one of them to win, but I kind of knew they didn't stand a chance, especially after Triple H derailed Van Damme at Unforgiven. Michaels, however, came under the radar after his big return at SummerSlam. I hate the guy's guts and was always a Bret fan in the 90s, but HBK has some uncanny ability to make himself so sympathetic despite being wrestling's biggest dickhead. It looked like a foregone conclusion that Triple H was going to win, and this was just before he would take over Raw and the big gold belt for an eternity, but there was HBK in his unfinished brown pants, flopping, bleeding, bumping and selling like no other. He truly is an incredible performer, and the fact that I was rooting for him at the end is a testament to his incredible ability, the dickhead. The main event gave us a new concept in pro wrestling, and that is always welcome. It was probably the last great pay-per-view before Evolution was born, and we had to watch Triple H batter everyone in sight for years. Seeing Triple H flop to the ground after a sweet chin music is arguably one of my favourite moments in wrestling. He was given the title, for God's sake. That infuriated me, and HBK delivering that kick was what wrestling should feel like, the heel getting his comeuppance. So after a barrage of fantastic feedback there from the emailers, very quickly around the table, best Survivor Series ever?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is absolutely my favourite, and you know, we've heard like what everyone's opinions are. And for me, like it's actually one of my favourite shows in general. I do go back to it with fondness. Madison Square Garden, my favourite venue. It always elevates any show just due to the crowd. First match, bit of a clusterfuck, but they right the wrong of, you know, Devon comes back, the Dudleys are back together again, so we don't have Reverend Devon anymore. Cruiserweight match was really fun. Enjoyed the hardcore women's match for what it was.
Ugh.
The tag team match I didn't think was as good as No Mercy, but then I hold that match at No Mercy as my favourite tag match of all time. But this was very good. But the two main events, I mean, even though the Big Show beat Brock Lesnar, it was the fact that Brock hits the F5 on him that did the most for me, because it was just the fact of like I was pissed off as long as everyone else that Big Show won, but I never thought I'd ever see him be able to pick Big Show up and do that move on him. It just seemed like impossible to happen.
Yeah. We were talking about it for months.
And as soon as he hit, I was just like, well, it doesn't matter. To me, it didn't matter that Big Show won, because it just meant he can F5 him. If you can F5 the Big Show, you're unstoppable. No one can beat you. So he's going to get the title back at you know, however long they're going to try and keep it away from him for.
I was outraged that it was the Big Show.
Well, I was outraged. Yeah. And just the logic of why would Heyman...
After watching, you
can't beat him. You can't beat the Big Show.
Yeah,
and that's the logic. Chef, but hang on, he's just throwing this big sack of shit around like it's nothing, and it's like you still turn, you fucking idiot.
Yeah.
But stupid that was.
And then, as I said, I can't really comment much more than what everyone else said on the main event. But it's just like I always felt a little hard done by that Sean's reign didn't last a little bit longer. I didn't like the fact he lasted the next month. Whilst all this is absolutely fantastic, the one thing I always immediately think of is give me the fucking mic. I popped so fucking much for that. We're like me and my friend Dean, we were big fucking Scott Steiner marks in the dying days of WCW, because there wasn't much to fucking cheer about. So when his music played and he came out, we had no idea what the performance like was going to be like in the following year. But we didn't care. It was just fucking big pop of pump. It's fucking awesome.
Killing fools.
Yeah.
I didn't like that Sean won the title in this match.
Ooh, really?
The story of Sean going for the title one more time should have been a big isolated focus on him.
I felt mentally unprepared for him to win.
Yeah, I totally, and it just it should have been it should have been the focus on Sean in a one-on-one match. Can he win the title one more time 4 years later? Just wasn't well executed in that presentation. Wasn't.
Who did you want to win?
I can't remember, to be honest, who I wanted to win.
I think we were kind of hoping for Van Damme at the time.
Really? It'd be Van Damme.
I can't remember. It was a waste of what should have been a special feel-good moment of the great man returning and getting his belt back.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It was just that thing about I'd written off, well, Sean's obviously not going to win because he's a part-time guy. So it's like I didn't even consider that it was an option, as opposed to actually if they'd built it up properly and done it in that way of Sean going for it. It's like, well, maybe they will. And even if I thought he wouldn't have, in that setting with that proper build, I would have exploded for Sean Wayne. In that case, I was just kind of like, what? My jaw just kind of hit the floor when the ref counted three.
Yeah, when you say it like that, if they did it so like Sean was somehow screwed again in the Elimination Chamber out of getting a title, and so it's the whole thing, you know, he has to win the Rumble.
See, you said last week my pet peeve of these matches where so many guys have to job. At least in Survivor Series tag matches, you don't have to have just one winner. I've always, my main gripe with the Chamber has always been you have five losers.
Yeah.
And
top guy losers too.
Yeah. That's really kind of stuck in my craw over the years.
I understand and agree with your premise for what they really should have done with Sean's last title win. Looking back, a singles build would have been much more impactful. And I think to that point, if you were going to go down that route, I wouldn't have had Sean in this match at all. I'd have kept him completely away from it. But that being said, as a match itself, as a standalone match, I enjoyed it.
Oh, it was fantastic.
Loved Triple H's crushed larynx even more. and as a card, you said best Survivor Series ever, as a sort of posing it as a question to us, and I'm struggling to think of any better off the top of my head. I really am. I mean, I don't share G's fondness for the Victoria Trish match.
When
I look back on that, all I really recall, the one vivid thing, is the trash can lid being put on Victoria's face and then kicked away for some unknown reason.
And then
she
sold it.
Yeah.
And they fucked up the finish, because I think the finish was supposed to be like she was going to hit it with a mirror and then someone trod on it and fucking broke it early. So, yeah.
Losers. Joe Lesnar. Yes, it's frustrating. It's the Big Show that gets the win, and there is a lack of logic in the way Heyman goes about the turn in the end. But it's short and spectacular nonetheless still, so it's a fun spectacle in that regard. So a really enjoyable show, probably the best Survivor Series card ever, and it's a rare moment where Survivor Series does maintain a sense of an individual identity because of the Chamber match, and that notion of, and I'll do it in air quotes, surviving.
Yeah, and they pushed that pretty hard too. So at this point, I think it's fair to say this is still a big deal as a pay-per-view. This is still like fairly easily number four.
Did they have the flashing lights for the entrances at this
point? They have the game show lights here,
didn't
they?
That's fucking stupid.
Yeah, and they actually fucked it up too, because they put it on the wrong one and Kane had to come out early.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus.
It went a lot smoother than when it fucking happened a couple of years ago with Mark Henry bursting through the glass and just standing there. That was this year, wasn't it?
This year, yeah.
Standing there with his dick in his hand while everyone else does spots around him. World's strongest spectator.
Yeah. I think he was actually moving towards them. He's just so slow these days. It's a continental drift kind of thing. It's moving. You need time lapse technology to register.
We move on there from what is arguably the greatest Survivor Series in history to another strong one here, 2003.
To the greatest Survivor Series match of all time.
Speaking of people there with a dick in their hand.
Laz from Pro Wrestling Only says, I actually love the Team Bischoff, Team Austin match from 03. HBK did a great job at being the valiant hero fighting a losing battle to me, and it was the moment I actually became interested in his post-comeback work. Libertine from the UK Fan Forum says it has to be the Team Bischoff, Team Austin from 2003. HBK's one-man show, with all the odds stacked against him, he managed to break your heart but win your love. Everything about Sean here was utterly perfect. Niall Clark from the Facebook page says 2003 had a great Survivor Series match with Team Austin versus Team Bischoff. I remember thinking that HBK was going to pull it off only for Batista to ruin it. I remember at the time being really pissed off, as it was meant to be the end of Stone Cold, who I grew up watching during the Attitude Era. Captain Ed from WrestlingForum.com says Undertaker beating the shit out of Vince is his fondest memory. Vince getting beat up is weirdly entertaining. Tom Campbell's back in and says this one's a cracker. The Team Angle Team Lesnar match, and that incredible Team Austin Team Bischoff Survivor's match that saw Sean put on a sensational performance, bleeding everywhere and battling for his life. I'm never sure why Vince felt the need to bleed in his match when it merely watered down Sean's unreal blading.
Love you, Tom.
Chaos Dark Soul from TPWW says the 2003 Survivor Series was pretty memorable to me just in general. John Cena's rap at the beginning always stuck in my mind, along with the ambulance match and the buried alive match. Nightro from WrestlingForum.com says the opening elimination match between Team Angle and Team Lesnar wasn't as spectacular as the later one, but it got the fans fired up and featured the jaw-dropping moment of Cena FUing the Big Show for the first time ever and Benoit making the champion tap out. Aside from Lesnar, while it didn't have the best talent on the team, I did like Team Lesnar, only because it felt like a throwback to the Survivor Series teams of old, where huge powerful monsters were paired together. Kane vs Shane was a fun hardcore match, Shawn Michaels puts on an all-star performance in the Team Austin-Team Bischoff match, and Randy Orton is the sole survivor, which he would repeat again in 2004 and 2005, giving him a huge rub and cementing him as the new Mr. Survivor Series. Taker vs. Vince was pretty much a one-sided beatdown, but it was intense and brutal and entertaining to watch. And finally, Air Raid from the UK Fan Forum says, my actual fondest memory is from Team Angle vs. Team Lesnar at Survivor's 2003, specifically the ending to the match. It's such a minor thing, but in Chris Benoit and John Cena, they had two guys out there that I desperately wanted to see in the main event picture to freshen things up for Lesnar and Angle without having to go back to Big Show, or Biker Taker yet again. The Crippler had long been my favourite wrestler since Bret retired, or possibly even earlier, and Cena had just turned and was the hottest new-ish act that everyone seemed dying to cheer for. Chris Benoit actually being permitted to elicit a submission from Brock Lesnar, even 2003 Lesnar, blew my mind, and made me excited to think they were about to embark on a main event push for him, which had long felt unlikely after being a supporting player for years. Just when I was calming down from that, Cena managed to lift up the preposterously huge Big Show with apparent ease for the FU and took the pin. As well timed as the Cena face turn had been, I was gobsmacked that on a team with Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit leading the way, it was Cena that was in the spotlight at the end. His turn had seemed really organic, like they had heard the reactions of the live crowds and thought, fuck it, let's go with it. It was really refreshing at the time, even if Cena's ascension was delayed due to the incomprehensible push of Ick, JBL.
I will say, you know, as much as it infuriates me because I'm looking at the two O'Rourke brothers here, your boy let my boy Steve down in the end. Let's not forget that. Glorious as it is, he ultimately failed, and I was deprived of Steve Austin for two whole weeks.
Well, came back as the sheriff.
Hey, he had a cool badge. That match, I think, is really good, and Sean's performance is outstanding. Obviously, the crowd are with it. Austin has his speech at the end, which, you know, I shed a tear to. Getting choked up now just thinking about it. But that aside, I do not share the emailer's love for this show.
Really?
I appreciate, you know, the notion of Cena and Benoit going over to freshen up the main event picture. Absolutely, he was a big Benoit fan at the time as well, but I never recall that being a particularly good match. You know, it wasn't terrible.
I thought it was fun. It was very fast paced.
It was fast, and you know, you have to be quite fast in it to get, you know, so that blur effect, so that you don't focus too much on the Colossus of Boggar Road and Matt Morgan.
The most generic big man to ever live.
Yes.
Generic name, generic title, generic music, generic action. Get the fuck out.
Yeah. The women's match is just there, really. It's neither good nor bad. The Kane-Shane McMahon feud, I absolutely detested.
Yeah, it was awful.
And did not enjoy the ambulance match either. Basham's and Guerrero's, wasn't a particularly big fan of that, especially the fact that the Basham's were going over. I know where it was leading with the breakup of Los Guerrero's, but I always thought the Basham's were criminally overrated by people within the industry who would talk about what good workers they were. Goldberg, Triple H, which surprisingly doesn't get mentioned much, or if at all, by any of the emailers there.
And I
can't imagine why. Possibly because all the bloom was off the Goldberg Rose at that point. They completely missed the window with him. And the Vince Taker match is absolutely fucking boring. only made slightly worse by the fact that it has an appearance by Kane.
How about Vince blading off one punch to start the match? That's one of my favourite things. It's like, Vince, you just seen Sean just cut himself a complete gusher. And then you just blade on one punch, and he was pissing blood too. And it was worse than Sean's.
On the whole, not a particularly memorable show for me outside of Sean's performance. And not one that I look back on really particularly fondly.
I find a little bit more enjoyment. I might go as far to say it's probably one of the last really solid Survivor Series shows, mainly because you know, the Survivor Series matches are actually pretty key, especially the Bischoff Austin one. The opening match with, as you said, with Cena, Benoit, Kurt Angle, and two nobodies versus Brock Lesnar's team. Yeah, I actually agree with one of the readers where they're saying it had that very kind of old school Survivor Series feel to him, even though it's like fucking Nathan Jones and Matt Morgan and A-Train and stuff. It's just the fact that it was something like, I think it hold, doesn't it hold the record for the heaviest team ever in Survivor Series, or like the most amount of meat or something in a team, I think they called it at one point.
Yeah, and I get as much entertainment out of that fact as I do the Raw Rumble video package every year.
But it was just that thing where it just seemed like Brock would obviously pick, you know, like these fucking man mountains to try and represent him over Kurt, you know.
Way to make your monster heel world champion look ace, but put him there with four people bigger than him.
Yeah.
Yeah, but significantly shitter.
But yeah, I just remember, you know, just being like a big fan of John Cena's babyface turn at the time and kind of like getting behind him. He seemed like the, you know, the future of SmackDown. I'm not quite as opposed to the Kane Shane McMahon match as Carl was. Like, oh, yeah. I was kind of.
There's two great moments though. First of all, the ambulance door to the face is just absolutely classic. And actually, the opening spot always got a chuckle out of me too, where Shane like dives at Kane, and the camera kind of completely misses where they land, but Kane like just goes flying off the screen head first to the concrete.
For the first few months of Kane taking the mask off, I was intrigued. So I think by this point I was still interested, but I wasn't much longer after this match. At the time, I didn't realise that Undertaker was going to come back as the Dead Man, which I was actually against. The main thing, the main selling point of this show is that Team Austin versus Team Bischoff match, and the only person really you can talk about is Shawn Michaels in that. And actually, I'll say Randy Orton as well. I think they did a good job of putting Orton over.
Orton RKO's Mark Cuban on this show too.
Yeah, that's great. Fucking eat it, you shit. That one, I like the dynamics of what they did on that one. And I talked in the last podcast about the classic storyline of the one babyface guy facing the insurmountable odds of the heel team, and this is like the greatest example of it in Survivor Series history.
Shawn at his best, classic Shawn, bleeding everywhere, the dying man, but he's alive still, he's not dead yet. The super kick when he then flops on,
Christian.
Oh god, beautiful. It's nice that Shawn's getting some love this week from the listeners after the lack of respect I feel he gets at times for being an alleged asshole.
I think there's anything alleged about it. There's at least emphasis on the Survivor Series matches here, and they did think that Goldberg Triple H revenge would be a big deal, even if it really didn't mean that much. Yeah. Moving on to the next year, we spent a lot of time talking about those four Survivor Series shows because I think, for me personally, I want to see what everybody else thinks around the table, this is the point, 2004, 2005, 2006, where the real kind of hazy period of the Survivor Series comes in. Some of these matches get a little bit foggy. We'll talk here about 2004. A couple of pieces of feedback is Zach Malibu from the FOW board says, I enjoyed the 2004 Winners Get Raw storyline, but they bombed it in the follow-up. I think the only notable thing to come out of it all was Maven's heel turn, which I think calling that notable was a bit generous personally. Tom Campbell's back in with this one as well and says, for the benefit of the room, I would like to throw one comical Survivor's event at you in the form of a question. Why, when Big Show had his ankle broken before the Survivor Series in 2004, did he bandage up his boot for the show?
Love you, Tom.
I know. This is classic wrestling, you know. You've got to see it. You've got to see it.
Bandaged the boot.
The bandage is around the boot.
Well, I don't know. Maybe with the swelling, or it was like. I guess his foot would look like, you know, someone baking a loaf of bread in a shoe. So maybe it was just, I don't know, for logistical purposes.
His foot, like you say, become that swollen. And him being a giant, the boot probably, you know, couldn't fit on properly. It was a bit mangled. So really, they had to cast around it for his own protection.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Does it? Although, actually, I will say, after watching the Packers-Broncos game, they did do the same thing to Clay Matthews when he tweaked his ankle. So they did tape up over his shoe and ankle. So maybe there is something to this. I'll try taping over my shoe at work next time
I hurt my
ankle.
I've done that before.
What, tape over your shoe?
Yeah, like when we play football and I've rolled an ankle.
At least that's probably a sock, though, right? Not like an actual boot.
Maybe it's to stop instability in the shoe, which would then cause pressure on the ankle.
So the leather's not going to do it, but the bandage will.
Well, hey, come on, Liam. When it comes to the Big Show, we know it's all about mobility.
The fact that we've been talking about this for so long goes to show there really was not that much else to talk about this pay-per-view. I didn't mind the main event. The main event seemed, you know, it was a very heated match. Orton wins, goes over, sole survivor again. But to me, there's very little else on this show to really sink your teeth into. And I think that it's kind of, this is a bad show. 2004 is a bad year for the company anyway, no matter how you slice it, as far as I'm concerned. And you see it here. I mean, Heidenreich, Undertaker, JBL, Booker T. The Survivor Series match from SmackDown is Eddie, Cena, Big Show, and Van Damme against Angle's great clique of Luther Reigns and Mark Jindrak, joined by Carlito, who had just debuted. And the one guy in the face team that gets eliminated is Van Damme, which just seems absolutely criminal. But that was the way they decided to go. And it just, other than Shelton and Christian, I enjoy. That was a good match on this show. But other than that, I don't really remember taking away anything other than Orton looked good, the crowd was hot, but again, it didn't mean anything.
Yeah, it's like you said, we've talked in detail about the few shows preceding this, and probably a good job that we did, because there's really nothing to say about 2004. It's you look at it on paper and it's bad. You watch the show and there's really nothing to it. The crowd are hot for the main event, and Orton really did need something given the trials and tribulations that he'd had of the previous couple of months.
Yeah.
But you know, the winner getting control of Raw for a week, you know, wasn't really much of a hook for me. We talk about 2001 and that being the last time it was significant. I suppose if someone wants to try and make a case for 2004, they're more than welcome to it, but they're not going to convince me anytime soon.
The only thing I really want to say is, remember my Heinrich sign?
I'll let you say it.
Yeah, I think it was it brutalized, victimized, sodomized?
Now you brought it to the SmackDown taping.
And a hide and shite sign as well made the cut. JBL's world title run, this to me exemplifies it. This is a match that no one remembers, nothing memorable about the feud. 2004 Survivor Series is to me a real noticeable shift from Survivor Series really mattering to just a show. Because to me, this was just a show.
I think it's just a show, totally right. Mark Jindrak, where the fuck did he come from?
Jindrak was like the reflection of perfection with Teddy Long for a brief period in 2004, and then out of nowhere they just kind of made him one of Angle's guys, along with Luther Reigns, who was helping him back. If you remember the era when Angle's in the wheelchair.
And also, just looking at this, actually,
rising from the stand in his wheelchair.
Actually, looking at this, I'm any show that has Snitsky in a main event.
So with that said about 2004, not a lot to sink your teeth into. The concept kind of feels like it's losing steam here, at least for this one year. But we've seen that previously in part one of this podcast that we did last week. Did they bounce back next year for anybody here? 2005 with the inter-brand match, Team SmackDown versus Team Raw. Randy Orton, again, the sole survivor in that one. BGillette86 from F4W says, the entire SmackDown versus Raw match, which is also the lead-up to Undertaker's return, was phenomenal. The match came down to Orton and Michaels, and it was just really awesome stuff. The high point of the brand split, in my honest opinion. And Phoenix20191 from F4W says, the Undertaker returning, I think, to attack Randy Orton, and Matt Hardy apparently getting out of the ring before being attacked by Undertaker, which I heard got him heat for not taking bumps from Taker, which is a true story. That is correct. That was part of the many things that they held against Matt Hardy during that period of time, and saw him losing, I think, to Tatanka on a SmackDown not that long afterwards. Yeah.
At least there's a reason for the for an elimination match. You know, as we were talking about before, they need a concept. The interbrand match was, you know, a natural fit, but was it for a cup or something?
No, not yet. That's the bragging rights era.
Forget.
Yeah, that's when it didn't matter.
Yeah, they had a reasonably decent concept that they could have used for Survivor Series, and instead decided to make it a completely different pay-per-view.
Before Survivor Series.
They tend to do that. Oh, yeah, of course.
What about Booker T. Benoit?
The best of seven series. It wasn't anything special. It was good.
There was some good in-ring stuff, but it just smacked of the old, we'll steal that old concept because we can't really think of anything else to do with these two at the moment.
Yeah.
You posed the question then whether or not it's sort of a bounce back for the show off the back of 2004, and for me, not really, to be honest. You know, breaking news, folks. The Team SmackDown Team Raw concept.
This was the first time they did it?
It's the first time they'd done it, but again, as someone who'd never really bought, maybe sort of being a bit too smart for my own good, perhaps. Yeah, thank you for that chortle off my
I'm the tosser. Okay.
I didn't mean it in that arrogant way. You know what I mean. God damn it.
Yeah.
Twist my words. But I never really bought into the brand split as a concept, so this is, by extension, is not something that had enough gravitas for me.
That's his way of showing that he is too intelligent for it, by the way.
So, yeah, I don't have particularly fond memories about this one. If anyone can remind me that John Cena Kurt Angle was anything special, I don't remember it being such.
It was fine.
And thought they'd had better and thought they'd had better earlier matches.
They did have better matches before. Last Man Standing wasn't
Last
bad.
Man Standing, I will say, I did really enjoy.
Flair bleeds a gusher.
There's a screwdriver involved. Flair flips off Triple H at the end.
all I can really remember the John Cena Kurt, I think I remember being pretty solid, but
Daivari was involved.
But yeah, but it was just mainly just the fact that Kurt was the babyface.
Yeah, this was the early days of John Cena getting a mixed reaction, folks. Those controversial superstars, those damn traditionalists, they just don't like John Cena. But yeah, I think that what the last 2 years shows too, obviously this is the brand extension era, something we didn't mention before, and I think that 2004 is the show that really first exposes when the roster depth on either side is really starting to weaken. It's the same with this one here, you know, Team SmackDown, Team Raw, but there's only like five other matches on the show, and there's not that much really to sink your teeth into. Teddy Long versus Eric Bischoff doing the job, by the way, thanks to the Boogeyman.
Oh god, yeah, the Boogeyman running. Oh.
This is also post Eddie Guerrero death, the fallout of the Eddie Guerrero death. So it's a very kind of uncomfortable, weird time, and they have the angle at the end where Taker comes out of the coffin and Michael Cole screams out how he's back from the dead, and it was really kind of uncomfortable to watch at the time. I wasn't a big fan of that. The funny story there that was mentioned of Matt Hardy, while everybody's in the ring celebrating with Orton, Taker comes out to slay the mid-card one more time, because that's just what The Undertaker does, and Matt Hardy had the audacity to get out the ring while everyone else was taking bumps and just walk off. And Taker watched it on the video the next day and paused it and rewound it and asked Matt Hardy, "What makes you think you're better than anybody else?" I really wish somebody would have asked him that back.
Yeah,
you know?
Fucking hell. Jesus Christ.
But anyway, yeah, maybe it's those matches with Heidenreich the previous year. Moving on now to the next year, 2006's version of the Survivor Series. Phoenix 20191 from F4W says, for his fondest memory, Shawn Michaels posing with Melina was hilarious. In fact, that entire match. The match even starts like the 2014 match, with Mike Knox getting pinned in the first 20 seconds from Sweet Chin Music. Panda Hugger from F4W says, HBK eliminating Knox after 10 seconds and asking, who was that? Was he in the match?
Yeah.
No, yeah, that was awesome. DJ Con 57 from F4W says, when CM Punk teamed with DX and the Hardys, it was super weird at the time. Punk just started a couple of months before, not even getting a super big push. Then he was on Raw being buddies with HBK and Triple H. Easy Go, I believe that's how his name's pronounced, from Pro Wrestling Only says, might get some shit for this, but the DX versus Rated RKO match is probably my favourite Survivor Series match of all time. I was the biggest HBK fan in the world back then, and seeing them sweep Rated RKO was all 9-year-old me wanted. Watching it now, it still holds up as a better than average comedy match too. And Noid from TPWW says, the only reason I can remember this show being in Philly is because of Philly Brooks. Better known to wrestling fans as CM Punk, or better known to Vincent Mann as AJ Lee's husband, was standing in the ring with Triple H, Shawn Michaels and the Hardys, with Triple H set to do the usual DX intro shtick,
yeah,
only to be cut off by CM Punk chance. I was in full smark mode at the time. The WWE product had been considerably stale to me, with forced push of John Cena, who I honestly was annoyed by before he won the WWE title. What with that mediocre of five series with Booker T, leading to him winning the US title from himself, cutting off Carlito's push, and then turning the US title into a physical metaphor for the company's direction at the time. I wanted something minty fresh, and not minties in the Spirit Squad's ring attire. I hated DX. They were like the two jocks in high school who thought they were funny. It's like Triple H heard himself getting cheered against Cena at Mania and thought, hey, there's something in this. Maybe if I re-team with my now bitter arch-enemy, I can stay on top as a face for 7 fucking years. Hearing the crowd chant for CM Punk floated my sinking heart at the time. Triple H even needed to acknowledge the chants from the crowd and pass the mic to Punk. This led to CM Punk losing his undefeated streak to Hardcore Holly and being eliminated from the Extreme Elimination Chamber first. Perhaps correlation and not causation, he says there. On this show, this is a show where I remember watching this at the time and just feeling like it was a very flat show. It didn't really, even with the supposed big moment at the end with Batista winning the belt from Booker T, it just felt, you know, confetti falling, you know, and it just felt flat. I wasn't a big fan of really anything on this show. I wasn't a fan of the company's direction in 2006 at all. And it, like I said, I think that pretty much sums it up. There was nothing here that I really enjoyed.
It's just the fact that the only thing I really like remember is the Punk chants and just seeing Triple H's face on it.
Glomming his way to get an arm around the shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, Punk, do you got something to ask them? And he does like, are you ready? And it's like, oh, don't lower yourself, Punk. Come on. Yeah, I don't remember hating the show, but at the same time, it's just...
I didn't hate it, but it was a blur.
It was a blur, yeah. I mean, the Spirit Squad.
Can't even get the Duke over Ron Simmons' team.
Yeah, but just the Spirit Squad.
Yeah, you were in the crowd at previous shows chanting the Spirit Squad names with the rest of them, so don't lie and pretend you weren't.
I liked them.
Yeah, well, there you go then. Benoit Chavo did nothing for me. James versus Lita and Lita's ex out the door. Crime Time.
Oh, with the... Well, they stole her luggage. And,
it's Lita's box. Yeah, we get the gag. There's a dildo in there that's sent to the crowd for a dollar.
What about Kennedy Taker?
gutless, absolutely gutless booking it. MVP accidentally busts open the Undertaker when he's swinging for Kennedy, and then Taker gets his heat back by absolutely fucking brutalizing Kennedy with a great chair shot, horse collaring him. Other than that, just again, the Survivor Series matches, they put big stars in there, but there was no focus on in the build up here. They kind of, it's kind of old school in a way, and this was the crisscrossing of feuds that were already in existence. But they announced the matches on WWE.com, for Christ's sake. So it's like it didn't feel important.
This doesn't necessarily have the problems that we had with the previous two shows, where there is actually like talent here. I mean, you still got like the names of like Chris Benoit and Edge and Randy Orton and so on, but you got both Hardys returning, specifically Jeff Hardy. You're getting kind of like young talent, like, you know, Johnny Nitro, Kennedy, MVP and so on, and Umaga all on the show. So there was like, the roster's better than what it was in 2005 and 2004. Like, looking at it,
just completely forgettable show. In fact, the only thing that I can vividly remember is the Punk chants.
Yeah,
I can't even remember the match.
Oh yeah, just the sweep, which I did get a chuckle out.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as Kieran really with this, in the sense of that the most memorable part of the show for me is the CM Punk chants. Gives you an indication of just how much of a throwaway it was, which is epitomised, like you say, Liam, by the fact that they announced the Survivor Series matches on WWE.com. As someone who was never a Batista fan, the glorious return of Big Dave was never going to do it for me, quite frankly.
Finally avenging that backstage job he did to Booker T that time. We move on to 2007, and we can be brief and get straight to it here, because not one person in the feedback decided to mention this show at all. Okay. Completely unspectacular in the eyes of the viewers, apparently, in terms of memorable moments and fondest memories. Hell in a Cell headlines this. So I actually love the Orton Michaels match on this show.
Loses to him again, though.
I know. Well, the whole story is he can't do the switch in music, so they're teasing, they build the whole match around Shawn Michaels kind of using the kick, or the threat of the kick, to throw Orton off guard, and he does it, and like, he has to do these different things. He applies the crossface for the first time since Benoit done his rampage. There's an ankle lock and a sharpshooter in there, so it's a really fun match to watch Michaels do different things that he wouldn't normally do to try and get the win. And of course, the great finish that I absolutely love is it comes to a scenario where Shawn has the chance to throw the kick and has to catch himself and stop right before he does it, and Orton RKOs him. He would have got him in a normal situation, but he couldn't in this case. And Orton, who was, I thought, at his peak here after doing the concussion tour earlier in the year, I was really on board Orton here, so I was actually not too sad about Orton getting the Duke. Other than that, Batista and Undertaker, you know, Hell in a Cell, Edge does a run in, but again, not particularly memorable. Survivor Series match, Triple H and Jeff survived. Jeff Hardy's on the road here to being extremely over, yeah, and he's going to get the match with Orton at the Royal Rumble, and the crowd's completely with him.
I just see Big Daddy V.
He wasn't bad in that match. He got to drop a big fat elbow for a finish. That was good.
And I also see on this little fact sheet you've given us, a great Carly beats Hornswoggle.
Yeah, that was.
By DQ.
Yeah, don't ask me.
Anyone remember that? Why was it DQ?
No, none of us were sitting on the committee meeting, G.
This was, if you recall, during the period where Vince was very irate that Hornswoggle was his son, so he booked a match with the great Carly on pay-per-view.
Whilst we talked about some, like, the early Survivor Series years, the fact that a lot of the matches are thrown together, there is still an emphasis there. And we see it dwindling as the years go by. Like you say, once you get to 91 and the focus is the world title match, you start to see the decline. And then you get these brief moments where they try and re-emphasize it again. 2003 being a good example with what happens with Shawn and sort of Austin's career being on the line. And 2001, and again, another prime example with the future of the company at stake. By the time we've got through to this period, and we've seen it with the previous few years, really, with 05, 06, there is really no genuine emphasis at all on them as matches or having any real high stakes at this point. They are literally just thrown in there because it's
something on the card.
Because it's something on the card, and because it's what we normally do on this pay-per-view.
And not put in a position at all to be responsible for drawing money. You see, Hell in a Cell with Batista and Taker, WWE title with Orton and Shawn, they're still putting big matches on the show, don't get me wrong. They're still treating it like there is some importance there, but just the Survivor Series concept
has been
lost.
We talk about that individual identity, it's
gone.
By this stage, it's completely gone.
I will say, thank God, though, that the Survivor Series rules weren't enforced in the women's tag match.
Yeah,
10 woman tag. That's quite the eclectic crew they've got together there. So
there were no jumping bomb angels in this one to make it watchable.
Yeah, losing of tradition isn't always a bad thing, I guess.
We're moving on to 2008, another show that got very little feedback. Boy Better Know from FOW, in the only comment that anybody said in terms of fond memory, said, "That boring match between Triple H and Vladimir Kozlov that Ed saved." That was absolutely hideous. That's one of the worst matches in modern Survivor Series history. Triple H, "Oh, let's see if I can be Ric Flair to Vladimir Kozlov and Nikita Koloff." The answer's no, you can't.
Most certainly not, and I know we talked about it briefly last week, but gee, you know, your favourite match, the casket match, makes a return here for the Undertaker beating the Big Show.
Yeah, the Big Show, one of his many turns here where he joined Vicky Guerrero for a brief period of time and then promptly lost to the Undertaker. This show was predominantly built around the return of John Cena, who had been absent since SummerSlam due to a neck injury. I believe he'd had the neck surgery here and come back in 3 months to come back and just beat Chris Jericho for the world title on his first night back, after Jericho had done all that work with the Michaels feud, which was particularly infuriating for me at the time, because I thought Jericho was really on a roll.
He was, and that was a great program through the autumn. It was one of those where I wasn't able to see the shows live at the time. I was living away at university, and I sort of I don't mean this in a bad way, but I constantly had you, Liam, telling me, "Have you seen the pay per view? Have you seen any of the build recently? You've got to get back on track. You've got to keep watching." You know, and I was glad for that belligerence, because when I was able to sit down and watch, I was like, "Yeah, this is really good." And you know, by the time I'd done all that to get up to speed with it and to be on track, to then have that happen, I think those are the moments where sort of the anti-Cena fans, if you like, look to and point to things like that. Yeah. Whether or not it's really his fault or not, and how much blame you want to put on the company, I think the anti-Cena mob will look to moments like that.
Three Survivor Series matches on this show, none of them meant a thing.
I can't remember a single one of them.
what was even the point of them? I mean, I'm looking at a team of Shawn Michaels, Rey Mysterio, Great Khali, and Crying Time. What the fuck did those guys have to do with each other?
Well, I believe that Shawn Michaels was in the midst of his deal with JBL that would end up with him owing JBL, him being in JBL's pocket, basically, right? Because he needed money, and JBL helped him out. Miz and Morrison were a team, so I guess them and Crying Time had dueling shows on WWE.com, which got mentioned during the broadcast for some reason, which leaves Rey Mysterio and MVP as the real toss-em-in-there kind of guys. They'd done Rey Mysterio and Michaels against Miz and Morrison on the previous Raw, where Morrison went over, he superkicked Shawn and pinned him clean, which is a big shock. And then at the end of this match, Shawn Michaels superkicks Morrison back and beats him. So there's nothing too bad, but it's just the thrown together nature of it before the show. There's no emphasis. One of the things that we used to see in those Survivor Series the early years was the team promos, and actually kind of developing some kind of team identity and a reason for the match to happen with these intermingling feuds. That doesn't happen here. It was just, this is the match, it's happening at the pay-per-view because it's Survivor Series. Similar with the other one too, Orton, Cody, Shelton, Henry and Regal against Batista, Punk, Kofi, Hardy and R-Truth. Orton and Cody Rhodes win. It was Orton's feud with Batista, which was happening at the time, one of the many. And again, Orton pinned Batista clean at the end, and there you go. That's that.
As innocuous as it may seem, or as irrelevant as it may seem, throughout this whole period, any notion of team names has completely fallen by the wayside as well.
Oh, no. Sorry, you're wrong there. It's usually Team Orton versus Team Batista, Team Michaels versus Team JBL. That kind of a thing. You get that a lot. But isn't that indicative
the wider point?
Yeah,
a team name in the grand scheme of things, is it going to add a buy rate? No, not a single one. Won't draw a dime. Won't draw a dime, Mike Graham. Won't draw a dime. But
it's still an exacerbation of the concept and the gimmick,
yeah,
isn't it?
It emphasises the lack of importance to me.
For me, the last few years that we just talked about are kind of the dark years of the Survivor Series, and maybe that differs around the table, maybe you guys think that the next couple are as well, but for me, this one here, 2009, is a little bit of a standout in the sense of, and we'll get to it here, not J Tab from Pro Wrestling Only says, "Maybe an odd choice, but I've always loved the opener to Survivor Series 2009, with Miz, Sheamus, McIntyre, Swagger and Ziggler versus Morrison, Finlay, Hardy, Bourne and Benjamin. It felt like a real drive to actually push new stars, with three members of the heel team standing tall at the end. 3/5 of the heel team were guys who had been around a while and were popular, but never going to be world title contenders, so using them to put over fresh guys made sense. McIntyre and Sheamus both got two eliminations, which made them them look great. Whilst the only members of the face team to eliminate anyone were Morrison and Bourne, the two with the most potential on their team. Miz, Sheamus and McIntyre looked like world beaters coming out of this match, and the fact that four of the five heels went on to win world titles, and it would have been all five if Drew Mack hadn't married a nutter, shows they were right to give these young guys a chance. And obviously another big thing on this show is Kofi Kingston. This was right after the MSG incident. He was in the midst of his feud with Orton. The MSG situation happened where he put Orton through a table and everyone was going crazy for Kofi, thinking this guy could be a star. He's the sole survivor in this match, beating CM Punk and Randy Orton at the end. First time in some time where the show actually feels like there is a concerted effort here to move forward with the future. That this was in the middle of that weird youth movement thing WWE had going on at the time. Kofi, Sheamus, McIntyre, Miz. Felt like it was needed. The flip side of that is the world title matches on this show, in both cases, I thought were completely lackluster. You know, two three-ways that were just kind of thrown together. The DX and Cena match, particularly, which was the main event, was built on comedy for the entire month going in. It was fucking horrendous. Kieran, I think you remember that feud in particular.
Yeah, I just... as a one-time wannabe booker, to build a world title around comedy is just...
makes me sick.
Fucking infuriating.
Three baby faces, too.
Yeah, I think... and that was the... It was just horrible. Like, it was directionless. And pretty much everything. I don't like multi-man matches as well, so that added to it. For you know, title, three-ways, etc. Yeah, just infuriating.
Whereas with the other years where it's sort of either unforgettable or just very dull or, quite frankly, head-scratching when you look at teams such as Sergeant Slaughter's team from a few years previous, at least with this, there's a bit of a sense of freshness, isn't there? I can go on and on about my dislike for The Miz, but, you know, I can at least give the company credit for the effort to elevate, if not new talent, certainly fresher talent. And the same with Kofi, that you did feel that this could be one of them to sort of break through. And you know, we all know how that panned out, but in the being a prisoner of the moment at the time.
Oh yeah.
And obviously you have the element where he's destroying Orton's car as well.
I just remember that the PW Insider report of this show was headlined with "A Star Is Born" referencing Kingston, and it didn't take long for that star to be flushed out completely.
No, it was a
stupid.
It was a falling star.
He's back now, baby.
He is.
In terms of any significance to Survivor Series as a show historically or as an identity, there's nothing there in that regard. And I would just completely echo the thoughts on the WWE Championship match. You know, funny isn't money at the end of the day, and you know, there is a place for comedy in wrestling. Not necessarily some of the WWE's attempts at comedy, but
it helps if it's funny.
Yeah, but there's
Big E's entrances are fantastic.
Yes,
his microphone.
Those.
Oh, Manchester! I'm gonna pop like a motherfucking expert.
those are glorious. But when it comes to your world title, whatever promotion you are, big or small, you know, regardless of the size of the company, you keep comedy away from your world title.
Nothing historically significant on the show in the long run. But again, because of the nature of the main events, where it's the established guys going against each other in matches that really don't change the course, nothing about this show feels emblematic of the time at all, other than it's a bland morass with a couple of stars attempted to be pushed.
Yeah, I mean, everything from 2005 through to this show is just hazy. I start remembering things when we get to 2010. I think it's probably because around 2010 is when they started kind of doing the better proper summer storylines, the big summer thing that they're going to do, and you know, with 2010 kicks it off with the Nexus and so on. But until then, you don't get that with the 2008 and 2009. There's no big summer angle which leads through to Survivor Series.
Very little emotional attachment.
Yeah, anything to make you want to go back and watch this show again.
Well, let's see if we have any with the following year. 2010, we're getting to here. None of the listeners thought that there was anything memorable about this one either, so we have no comments from you, the loyal listeners, on 2010. We'll get to it here. Obviously, you mentioned there the big summer angle was the Nexus. It built to the crescendo of Randy Orton, the champion, defending against Wade Barrett, John Cena referee, with the stipulation of Wade Barrett wins the belt, or he will fire John Cena. They did a thing here, obviously, where Cena was subservient to Barrett for the course of a few weeks on Raw, which did have the great moment where Barrett threw the water in Cena's face and you have to stand there and take it.
Yeah.
But other than that, I wasn't a big fan of the direction at the time. Kane and Edge fighting for the world championship was dross. The tag team titles, you think it's bad now. Justin Gabriel and Heath Slater beating Vladimir Kozlov and Santino Marella. Again, another Survivor Series match that is just completely forgettable here. There's only one on this show, and it's Mysterio, Big Show, MVP, Kofi, and Chris Masters beating Del Rio, Swagger, Cody, Drew McIntyre, and T-Rex.
Tyler Rex,
wow. We hardly knew you.
Just a quick point I would like to make, and sort of you see it with the trend of these shows. Harping back to that traditional elimination match, the notion of it being thrown together, just as again another reference here, the fact of, you said there, Lynn, there's only one of these on this card. And the fluctuation in numbers that you see from year to year, you know, you'll have on some shows you'll have two or three, on some shows you just have one. Again, it has that haphazard sort of quality to it, and it's probably just the way in which they're reacting to what their perceived views of their roster strength, I suppose. But like you say, it's promoted heavily around Orton and Barrett with Cena as the ref. The problem there was you felt like they'd missed the trick with the Nexus, hadn't they? They'd missed the trick by having the Nexus job at SummerSlam.
Yeah.
They'd done irreparable damage, and this was them almost trying to reheat it in the Cena playing off as the almost the butler type role sort of thing. And then like you say, you look at the rest of the card, and Kane and Edge, I just remember that being an awful feud on SmackDown.
And it got worse after this.
And yeah, it would only go on to get worse. Natalya beating the co-women champion and champions in Lake Hall and all that sort of thing. It's just, you get the sense of, in the summer, they had something with the Nexus. They'd almost found a little bit of a groove. They made a bad call, and they were just trying to scramble and sort of refine their footing again. I think you see that with this card, really.
The whole Nexus angle, that first angle, was like probably my favourite angle on Raw of all time.
The thing is, we talk about it as well, like, Survivor Series needs kind of the natural team for a match to be structured around.
Yeah.
And Nexus seemed... how the fuck do you already drop the ball so bad that you don't have a Survivor Series match with Nexus?
Because they did that at SummerSlam instead.
Yeah. Well, that shows you the point being how little importance they put on Survivor Series.
They didn't even think to do it in 3 months' time and build it to that point. They said, well, we've got it now, so let's do it now.
Even if you wanted to do it, you've done this first fall at SummerSlam.
A big tag match, no eliminations.
Yeah, and then that's the build. They have to go through the team one by one.
I'm probably the only one that thinks this, but I really thought they missed a trick by not giving Barrett the title.
The question I would have there, I think Carl, you're probably about to jump in and say the same thing. Yeah. Who won the belt the next night, do you remember?
Oh, The Miz?
Yeah.
Oh, right, oh, okay.
So that's why, I guess they had a choice for who was going to be the heel.
Yeah.
And they went Miz and
they
not Barrett.
The Miz. Oh, okay.
Again, speaks to my point of, they'd made a wrong decision at SummerSlam. They knew it, and they were struggling to sort of regain their footing.
Yeah.
SummerSlam, as we know, has always been their second biggest show. It's not their second biggest in terms of buy rate, traditionally, but they've always tried to treat it that way. You know, they don't think far enough ahead to have the match at Survivor Series. You know, that's a whole other story about WWE's lack of forward planning. But then to still have them as a group and then not even do a Survivor Series match there, as you say, it shows the lack of regard, really, that the company has for the show. By this point, it's the November pay-per-view that just happens to be titled Survivor Series. And, oh, we used to do those matches, let's throw one on.
Daniel Bryan defending the United States title against Ted DiBiase and winning. I was obviously a big fan of that. Anytime Daniel Bryan was coming out and they weren't completely burying him, I was just, like, ecstatic.
Cole was in his insufferable phase.
Oh,
here,
he could go fuck himself just for that. He should get a trial.
You weren't one of the coal miners, then?
No, I certainly fucking wasn't. But I wish he stayed in that fucking box and they filled that one with cement. And then you get the Intercontinental Championship with Dolph Ziggler versus Kerval, which is low-key for those of you that might have forgot what his other name was. This whole thing was just ridiculous. They make him win the second series, right? And so then, right, because this Vince doesn't fucking like it, decides, no, unlike, Wade Barrett, who actually cashes in his title opportunity at the world title, Kerval, the retard, decides to go and cash it in for the Intercontinental title, and then on top of that, lose. And then after
and then
that, and then get fired afterwards. We're feeding the poor with one person already. We're not going to do it with this other midget.
Yeah.
So he can go and fuck off and do the job to a former cheerleader.
Go back to hosting the Crystal Maze.
Exactly. And so it's just, the thing I remember the least is the Survivor Series match.
Moving on here to the next year, because while we have for the last couple of years have seen a bit of a noticeable de-emphasis on the show in itself, They went with something big here for 2011. AT&T Stadium from Wrestling Forum says, for his fondest memory, The Rock coming back to wrestle in 2011 was big, even if it was a huge disappointment. And Punk winning the belt from Alberto Del Rio, with The Fink announcing him winning and his entrance. Hunter Hurst Helmy from F4W says, CM Punk winning the WWE title in MSG with The Fink as his special ring announcer. And T-Lynch 106 from F4W was at this one too, and said it was great just for the time period. Zack Ryder was over like Rover during this show, and the whole night the Garden crowd chanted for him, to the point that the people chanted for Ryder during The Rock's post-match promo for the live crowd, and Rock acknowledged it.
Yeah, this fucking main event, this whole thing with the Miz and R-Truth getting buried, and I know
the awesome truth.
Yeah, awesome truth, and I know there's people brandishing
chest bump and fucking ridiculous stare at each other lustingly.
and I know there's plenty of people around this table that didn't lose any sleep over the way these two were treated, but still,
I do.
It was ridiculous. I mean, the main thing I couldn't just remember was the. I think, was it a Hell in a Cell?
Yeah.
Where they attack him inside the cage, and then like the police turn up and they just do that thing where they put their hands up and immediately take the position.
And then Triple H comes and gets his licks in just
because he's got his wad out. And it's just, no, this was just awful. And like,
what a waste of The Rock's first match back.
Yeah, it was such a, I can see why they're doing that, but I also see why they did it as well. I can see the fact that The Rock facing Cena at Mania was going to sell no matter what anyway, not just because it was The Rock's first match, but it was because he was facing John Cena and it's WrestleMania. So I could see what they were doing, as they were trying to divide the potential drawing power, I guess. Like, if people are already going to turn up at WrestleMania for him to face Cena, then they'll turn up at another pay-per-view and try and push that buy rate up.
Yeah, Vince saw that with Tuesday in Texas. That didn't work either.
Yeah, I can see why they did it.
Because he's fighting the fucking Miz and R-Truth.
Yeah.
And teaming with the one guy no one wanted to see him team with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but there was something there you could... There was a dynamic there you could have... That would have been okay to lead to WrestleMania if you'd use it as a stepping stone into Mania.
But well, they thought in theory they did. They in theory thought, yeah, oh, he rock bottomed him at the end of the show, so that boosted it.
Yeah, but it's so part in.
Agreed.
Listen to like the Table of Three recently that has actually these two guys on it, Miz and R-Truth. These two guys don't have anything bad to say about this match, believe it or not. But like the fact that they were treated so poorly and pretty much buried, and neither one of them, their careers have recovered from this.
Oh, R-Truth was lucky to be there, and he's lucky to still be employed.
Yeah, and that's the key. They're still employed, so what the fuck are they going to say about it?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, I felt ripped off. The company did shit with me and buried me.
Well, the fact that they don't have no gripe at all, and they just turn around, they're just reminiscing about it as if it's like fucking Andre versus
that's
Hogan.
That's the Miz, though. Miz is going to lick ass until the day he dies. Until the day he's fired, he's licking ass.
He'll still be shilling when he's fired in the hope he gets a job back.
Yeah, he will be. He will be one of those guys.
I don't particularly care about the way the Miz or R-Truth were treated, frankly.
I will say this much. If they were going to put them in this position, and they were going to prioritise them over CM Punk, who was getting really, really hot this year, and they decided to team Punk with Triple H to lose to Miz and Truth, specifically with Punk doing the job, and then having Triple H beat the shit out of him on Raw, and then having John Cena beat them up by himself on Raw before Survivor Series, to the point where why is The Rock even there? It was such... For The Rock coming back after all this time, the build was so disappointing.
I mean, don't get me wrong, when I say I have no problem with them being treated the way they were, I'm speaking sort of the personal vindictive sense of Miz and R-Truth are lucky to even be on in the main event, and they don't deserve to be there, so I've got no qualms about them being rolled in to do the job. You're absolutely right, in terms of a build and the way in which you're going to bring The Rock back, it's a terrible idea.
On paper, the idea of, okay, they're going to be fired from the company, they're going to invade, and they're going to do this big crazy scene that G mentioned at Hell in a Cell, where they're going to put so much heat on them for ruining the main event, and they're going to get arrested and carted out. The idea of trying to make them as the dangerous outsiders, which first of all has its issues, because it's the Miz.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Well, that's it.
R-Truth is in the middle of a great run as the crazy heel, so I've got no problem with R-Truth. But it's just that thing of, if you're going to do this, do it right. But they did it, and they did it wrong anyway. So,
but if you're going to do that concept, you really can't go with those two individuals, can you?
Probably not. No.
The big summer angle was CM Punk, and the whole, you know, he was going to leave, and the Money in the Bank match, and winning the title and stuff. Punk was absolutely red hot by this point. Surely, okay, you probably wouldn't get the numbers that Rock could potentially get, but surely they should have just gone with Punk winning the title as the main event and not need to do the Rock on the show at all.
They called him off by this point. Yeah. By this point, the balloon was well off the rose.
I would argue at this point, the summer of Punk is a distant and hazy memory. You know, he's done the job to Triple H.
Lost to Del Rio. Lost in rematches.
Had the back and forth with Nash that he never got the payoff because he never got the win because there was never a match. Imagine
that. Some truth, as we mentioned before.
So, but Del Rio even mentioned it in a promo in the build up towards the match when Punk wants a title shot. And he says, "Why would I give you a title shot when you've lost on the last however many pay per views it was?" So what does that tell you? In terms of any significance for Survivor Series and The Rock being brought in, I think it has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that the show's Survivor Series, and more to do with the fact of we're approaching Mania, we're getting in that ballpark now, so we want him involved, and this show's actually coming from MSG.
And Rock personally wanted to do the show, didn't he?
Yeah. So that, you know, and Rock's schedule allows for it, so that's how it comes about. I don't think it has any. I don't think there's any correlation between Survivor Series and The Rock in that regard.
Moving on now to the following year, 2012. Dalton Imperial from the FOW message board says, "My fondest memory of Survivor Series from this period of time is The Shield's debut in 2012, primarily for what they have become and what they might be in the future. Great look, shocking entrance. Would have been better if it had been Ryback's first loss. I would have pinned him instead of how Brad Maddox low-blowed and fast-counted the month prior, and they just seem cool." That is the big takeaway from the show, is the debut of The Shield. But in terms of the actual show itself, Punk, Ryback, Cena, three-way main event, two Survivor Series matches on this show, again, neither of them really feel like they had massive consequence. Originally, it was supposed to be Mick Foley in this match, if you recall. It was supposed to be Foley on the babyface side, primarily going against Ziggler, who was getting a little bit of a mini push here. Ziggler pins Orton to win the match, too, so that this is one of the many stop-start pushes for Ziggler.
I'm going to say that was the only real significance I took from the Survivor Series matches at the time, thinking, is this the point where they finally pull the trigger on Ziggler? As you referenced there, stop start, and we know it's panned out for him. Yeah. But like you say, outside of that, there's nothing to be taken from any of the Survivor Series matches. And
tell me more about that Antonio Cesaro R-Truth title defense, Carl.
I would, but my level of intelligence is such that I would go into such great detail that it would only serve to confuse our listeners.
You don't want to speak above anybody's heads.
Absolutely not.
What a fall from grace for R-Truth from the previous year, by the way. Main eventer with The Rock losing to Cesaro.
Sheamus, Big Show. I thought that was actually better than it had any right to
be. The whole series was better than it had any right to be. It wasn't the best match they had. They had one at Hell in a Cell, I believe, the month before, which was when Big Show won the belt, which was a staggeringly good match for the Big Show.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right there. It was a better match the month before. Admittedly, expectations were low, but at least it far surpassed those. It was sort of pleasantly surprising. But yeah, this show is all about one thing, really, and that's The Shield.
Yeah, CM Punk, Ryback, Cena, built up over the course of the previous couple of months. Cena had been injured. They just stuck Ryback in the Hell in a Cell. They jobbed Ryback out. He did a surprisingly good buy rate, so they went with him again. And this was the start of Ryback trying to be the opposite of Goldberg, I guess, in response to the chance and losing every match instead.
Was it five or six?
No, more than that. Let's have a quick check here. So Hell in a Cell, he lost, right? That's his first big loss.
To get it done quickly, he loses every match up to WrestleMania, pay-per-views. I'm talking every pay-per-view match. In he loses, he gets to WrestleMania, wrestles Mark Henry, loses. The next month at the pay-per-view, he's wrestling John Cena for the title,
and
loses.
And then they do a rematch the month later,
where he loses. Yeah. I actually think I can't remember who he beats, but I think it's close to a full calendar year before he gets a pay-per-view win.
Yeah. Or like Rey Mysterio, Sin Cara, Tyson Kidd, and Gabriel and Brodus Clay teaming up together. What the hell?
Look at the dream team they're facing. You thought Colonel Mustafa's team in Night 1 was the shit. Tenzai.
Primetime players and Primo and Epico.
And I'm not saying they're all bad workers or they're devoid of anything. Yeah. Tenzai was just a massive failure by that point. And the primetime players and Primo and Epico weren't exactly setting the world afire either.
Just because there was such a significant moment, is 2012 more linked to something like 1990
with Taker.
With Taker, where this one it's the debut of The Shield, which was like a fucking red hot angle right till its end?
No, because they're no longer together. They're invariably weaker than they were as a collective, and 15 years from now I don't think anyone's going to remember it.
I don't know. I disagree with that. I think that time's going to tell the story, but I think that this may well be in 5 years' time. People are like, man, you know, this year. It's something the, and the reason is, it's something the company's going to drill home into people when they need to, because you just know that one day they're going to be back together again.
I'm going
to
mark out like a motherfucker. Yeah,
everybody's going to mark out. Oh. Everyone's going to look.
Well, as long as Reigns changes fucking music.
That is a problem with it, I will admit to that.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. But again, I don't think that has the impact of The Undertaker. Don't get me wrong. I'm not disagreeing with you there too much. But I think that this will be something that they refer to in future. We move to 2013 here. To me, this is a real low point for Survivor Series history. This was one of the ones where they went all in on the big show. This was during the summer where the big angle, I guess, was Daniel Bryan and Cena. Cena's injured. Oh, he fucks off.
God,
City.
Yeah.
Orton and Daniel Bryan, a bunch of very poorly purchased pay-per-views during that period of time. And then he takes a backseat to the Big Show, who they're really building up. They actually did a fairly admirable job building up the Big Show for this match with Orton when they did he's fired, the sympathy stuff. I remember him coming through the crowd and costing the Shield the tag team titles against the Rhodes brothers, and the crowd going absolutely crazy for that. And then about 3 or 4 weeks before the show, when they're actually going to pull the trigger on this match, they just completely soured on it, and Big Show was barely promoted at all. Orton just beats him here, and then he's dancing in the Baby New Year nappy, or diaper for you American listeners, a few weeks later. The only thing that ever really got any kind of mention here, Harmonic Generator from the UK fan forum says, Roman Reigns. In that opening match, he was the man. I have to wonder what might have happened if they just ran with it, capitalized, and have him win the Rumble in 2014. Maybe it would have failed, but based on his performance here, I'd have believed. T-Lynch106 from F4W with a fun little note here. 2013, though a throwaway, was cool just being in Boston because we scored killer seats for cheap. Before the show, we talked to John Cena a senior and spoke to me like a human being, then cut a strange promo on my girlfriend and said, you may think because you met me that you're one degree away from someone famous, but we all know you're really here to see Johnny Fabulous, baby. And gave her a signed $1 million bill with his face on it. Afterwards, my girlfriend was blown away to find out it was actually John Cena's dad and that he acted so silly. So funny little off-air notes there. But in terms of the Survivor Series itself, I really enjoyed the opener to this show. The Shield, who were just fucking awesome in any multi-man match they ever had.
The one thing I just kind of like noticed and interesting here is how, like, these last few years we've had red hot SummerSlam, or, you know, at least Summer angles, and then by the time we get to Survivor Series, they're completely
all dead.
You know, we talked about the Nexus, we talked about the Summer of Punk that ended prematurely. 2012 was the Punk heel turn, which you didn't mention. And then this year, what was this year's big...
There really wasn't much this year, to be quite honest.
For a while, Cody Rhodes and Goldust were fucking over as Rover. You know, they were freaking hot. And
the big angle,
like,
was Daniel Bryan.
They had something with Goldust and Cody Rhodes. And it may have been very short-lived, but I don't necessarily agree from a long-term perspective in the fact that they had them beat the Shield at that pay-per-view, But at least there was a feel good moment too. You know, Dusty's in tears, the hugging at the end.
I liked it. I thought that was good. If you're gonna save those jobs sparingly for the Shield, but when they do, they mean the world, and they did it.
And it meant something there.
Absolutely.
But within two or three weeks, it had gone. And by the time you get to Survivor Series, that's gone again.
They're losing in the opener.
Is such a trouble? Do you reckon? This is what your point is making about. Yeah, No direct kind of directionless summer steam falling away. Is it because of the time of year? It's now there's no emphasis on the show because they're really in that transitional period, almost getting ready to launch WrestleMania season, as they call it.
By and large, they get lazy now, don't they? They get lazy, and because it's not like it used to be. We referenced about the earlier shows where you're only getting three. You know, it's the second oldest pay per view. Mm. So initially, you've only got two pay per views, then you've only got three. Even up until 95, the turn of 95, up until then, it was still only five pay-per-views a year. So that in itself lends it more significance. By the time you've got to this stage, and a pay-per-view every month is par for the course and to be expected, they just, by and large, they get lazy.
Sometimes two a month.
sometimes two a month during that period. So, when you had to throw your Taboo Tuesdays in and all that period.
Then 2006 one week later was ECW December to Dismember.
So by the time we've got to this period, they throw out some formulaic stuff because they're waiting for the real money period when they get to January and they push towards Mania. And also, it's football season again. So again, they get a bit lazy there and almost have their inbuilt excuse for not trying, don't they? So
what? We're watching the game. So
time to book.
So, No, but it becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? Like, you know, why put any good stuff in now, or sort of like what we consider our real A-grade stuff, because it's only going to get hurt by football anyway, so why not leave it to a period where the football season's dying down and there's more focus, you know, there's more eyeballs on it naturally.
A lot of people, and we're guilty of it too, look for the things that feel like turning points. And you know, Money in the Bank has the built-in turning point, you know, in theory of, you know, this guy's going to be the next world champion. We have to pay attention to this because this is something that we know is going to play a role going forward. Rumble the same, Mania the same, SummerSlam the same. Survivor hasn't had that many moments. I mean, we've mentioned it here. 2013 main event, Randy Orton, The Big Show. A Survivor Series match hasn't headlined this show since 2005 by this point. And the first one will be 2014. And with that said, it moves us very naturally to the final one that we're going to talk about here today, 2014. And of course, when it comes to fond memories, there's really only one thing from this show to take away. Your fight site from the UK fan forum says, for me, it can't be anything but Sting's debut at the 2014 show. The man who everyone thought would never step foot in WWE doing so, especially after Team WWF easily dispatched of a team from the Alliance that was comprised of two WWF turncoats, an upper mid-carder from both WCW and ECW, and a part-time wrestler, and then WWF board member in the 2001 edition. Random legend from F-Order, he says, last year was pretty cool. Great story, great build-up with good roars, fun match, Sting debuts. Of course, it all got negated by the Authority coming back 4 weeks later, Ziggler going straight back to the mid-card, and Sting jobbing in a nonsensical match that had nothing to do with the storyline. Norcross RD from F4W says, being so excited to finally see my favourite wrestler Sting in a WWE ring, and mere minutes before he came out, my son woke up screaming with a 104-degree fever. It ended up being a malfunction with a device, so it only was a minor fever, but got him some pain relief and went back to sleep, then having it right there on the network to watch. So at least his priorities are straight. And Owen SES from WrestlingForum.com says, I'll have to go with Sting's debut last year. It was rumoured something might be happening, but you could never quite believe it until it happened, and I think the crowd felt the same way. So this, as we mentioned there, the first time the Survivor Series headlines this pay-per-view for almost 10 years. It's Team Cena versus Team Authority. Again, in the long run, doesn't mean that much. Ziggler's the one that gets the win here. Big Show does a heel turn again. With the exception of that match, last year didn't have much going for it whatsoever. Adam Rose and the Bunny made the pay-per-view, if you recall.
Against Heath Slater and Titus O'Neil. Remember that team?
Slater-Gator, yeah.
Remember that team?
Wyatt and Ambrose go to Adiki to set up TLC, the pay-per-view after. So again, it's been used as a stepping stone for...
And also, this doesn't mean nothing to the other half of the table here, but like, this is where Nikki Bella starts her freaking title reign as well.
No, that means nothing to anyone.
Yeah.
No,
it doesn't mean anything to me. I freaking hated it, so...
It's not like Bella stellar lineage before that, let's be quite honest. It's not like this is Arquette winning the fucking WCW belt or something like that. Don't think so.
It doesn't matter!
Awesome. So with that said, I mean, that pretty much, I mean, if anybody has anything else they want to say about last year's installment of what, you know, again, historically it was the continuing of a trend, at least they built up a big match, as big as it really wasn't in the end. In theory, they built up a big match with the Survivor Series rules to blow it off on this show, natural because of the Authority storyline. But again, and it was a good match, I really enjoyed the match itself, but again, long term, it's not going to resonate, I don't think, other than the debut of Sting looking particularly ginger on this night.
Although there was a Survivor's match as the main event, which was, you know, more than previous years, as you said, it was still so short term and irrelevant. It was very much in the vein of an Elimination Chamber short term setup, pay it off, get it out of the way, and we move on with things.
Yeah, well, just we'll wrap this up here because we're looking at, again, big picture, relevance, identity. You know, over the course of two podcasts, we've talked about every Survivor Series thus far. A couple of comments here I want to get to in closing. Tiger Rick from the UK Fan Forum says, I'm actually scared by how little I can recall from 14 years of Survivor Series. Even reading the results through Wikipedia doesn't bring most of it back. It's so utterly unmemorable. In some ways, though, I'm glad that stuff like Mr. Kennedy beating the motherfucking Undertaker and Vladimir Kozlov getting a world title shot has been eroded from my mind. And Cobra 1000, also from the UK Fan Forum, says, the state of Survivor Series is pretty tragic. I think after the first few editions, they just decided it wasn't as important as the other shows. But truly, the 2000 show the decline of one of the most special shows in wrestling. I don't understand how they can't figure out how to book great stories through multi-man matches running into and out of the pay-per-view, but whatever. It's like they made this amazing concept that can tie wrestlers into feuds and make them interesting and give us reasons to invest in them, and then go, ah fuck, why bother, let's just have Big Show in the main event. I hope someone mentions that Triple H Kozlov Edge debacle too, what a fucking joke. And yeah, so we have mentioned that in passing, but I think that kind of is the general sentiment for wrestling fans out there, obviously fans of our ilk as well, when it comes to the state of this show. a lot of fond memories in the early years that we talked about last week, even if those matches weren't necessarily any more important than the ones that we've seen here. You know, I mean, again, Carl, you mentioned that some of the horrific ones in 91, and even then, going back even earlier, there were ones that really don't mean that much in the big picture, but it's entertaining because of the nostalgia and the stars involved and things of that nature. By this point, does it feel like there's any more life to the Survivor Series idea? Is there always going to be the ability to kind of build up that one big match, blow it off at Survivor Series, and people will be happy with it?
Well, at the risk of being uncharacteristically negative, unfortunately, I don't think so. Liam has, for the purposes of this show, as with the previous Survivor Series show, has done sort of cheat sheets for us, if you like, just as a refresher of the cards. And, you know, obviously the listeners can tell, and the general vibe we've got, the way we have blown through some years quite quickly there.
Yeah, the amount of time we spent talking about the first four today compared to the following 10 illustrates a big part of this.
It shows you just how little significance the company give to it, and how that's just sort of fallen by the wayside, bar the occasional exception, which, whilst in the moment may seem relevant, like Team Cena versus Team Authority last year, in the grand scheme of things don't mean as much. And I do find it quite sad. There isn't, I do have a nostalgia for the show, and it sort of harks back to my childhood, sentimental side to it there for me. And probably because of a point Kieran raised last week, it came at a time when there's less instances of having the big talent together, because we're treated in those days to a diet of wrestling challenge or superstars, where it's invariably jobber matches to enhance certain stars, maybe the occasional sort of match between a couple of mid-carders perhaps that you might get.
Well, Satellite's main event once in a blue moon.
Yeah, but by and large, that was the one time where you saw the mass of people together. So it hadn't, just naturally had more of a significance then, whereas we've got to the stage now, there's more pay-per-views, we have a TV wrestling diet, if you will, where you have the established stars, again in air quotes with the way they book these days, facing off against each other and regularly interacting, so it loses a bit of lustre in that sense. And like I say, we blew through so many shows quite quickly after those first four, as you say, that I think that just it exemplifies the almost irrelevance that it's become as a standalone show, hence the point that the company have flirted on a few occasions with potentially dropping it from the calendar completely.
In general, there's so little value left to the Survivor Series because of the nature of the business now. But that's not to say that if you got a group that was hot, came in and it was hot, especially if it was fresh, that you couldn't, like Nexus, if it was purposely directed to a match of significance at Survivor Series, something at stake, it could mean something. I don't think that'll happen, because 2 weeks after debuting the group, they'd have already done this gimmick on TV anyway.
Would admit SummerSlam.
Twice, yeah. So in reality, probably not. Maybe, do you think if they did like an NXT and kind of...
I was actually going to say the same thing once you were done. I was thinking like with your remark about doing something. Yeah, they could do like team main roster versus the NXT guys. I think that could be interesting. Or and again, that might, I don't know if that would be just a one shot deal, whether that's something they could do every year, where you would always have, but that you'd always have NXT versus the other roster, the Raw roster. But
yeah, I'm not saying it's a good idea. I'm just
yeah.
Would it garner any interest? That's what I'm saying.
I think you could. It's on the basis of it. We're doing this very special thing this year. The NXT guys, the best of NXT, are going against this guy. And obviously it's like that kind of soft introduction to people like Finn Balor or Samoa Joe, something like that. These are some videos of their finest moments. And then obviously you can have them on Raw doing, matches for the preceding month, killing people, looking good. And then you have the NXT All-Stars against a bunch of, established WWE guys. And it gets that kind of excitement going. And again, I'm like, it's kind of a soft launch for some of these guys. And, when they come up full bore, or you can even do stuff coming out of it where, you can pretty much introduce some guys based off that.
Yeah. It's not just simple as just like, well, if they just do Survivor Series matches, it'll work fine. It's not that the concept's been completely blown through now. I mean, they're going to find like something extra, I think, on top of it. So if they did maybe something like a regular NXT versus...
If you could do regular, but at least for a couple of years or something, a novelty kind of
couple
a thing.
Years.
You could potentially...
Nothing lasts forever. So,
no, as we've seen with the the importance of Survivor Series, yeah, in truth. I suppose the only thing I could suggest with NXT to sort of, because that in itself, whilst it might be a nice soft launch for a few guys, it might work well for a couple of individuals, it's not going to really give any prestige to the event itself, I don't think. I suppose the one thing you could possibly do to give the idea of a tangible reward is that if there are any NXT survivors, they're up into the, yeah, main roster. But then I suppose, again, to counteract my own argument there, they generally bring guys up throughout the year anyway, so so they get up there without anything, so it's a bit of a fait accompli, I suppose. But I think even if they were to do it, the show and the concept's taken that many knocks in truth in terms of giving it any wider importance outside of just that one night, and sort of restoring it to any sort of, not level pegging, but sort of trying to push it up closer to the significance of a Rumble, WrestleMania and SummerSlam, I don't see a way back for it in that sense.
Yeah, the fact that The Rock came back, and obviously with the booking being what it was and everything, even that couldn't launch this, the Survivor Series into the upper realms when it comes to the buy rate, I think speaks volumes to the potential ceiling, if you will.
What really kills it for Survivor Series, even though it was kind of limping up until that point, was Money in the Bank. I think as soon as they started doing Money in the Bank pay-per-view, that knocked Survivor Series away from its top four spot in terms of being key pay-per-views. I think it took over. It started off that whole gimmick pay-per-view thing that we have now, where we have TLC shows, Hell in a Cell shows, we've had fucking Fatal 4-Way shows, Breaking Point shows, all that stuff. And when you have a show like Survivor Series, which is a gimmick show, the original gimmick show, and now all the pay-per-views are gimmick shows, Survivor Series now just becomes one of them. You could also maybe argue Royal Rumble, but somehow Rumble's managed to retain that kind of mystique and significance.
The tangible reward for the winner.
Yeah, exactly. But Survivor Series doesn't have that, and so because of that, it just melds in with the Hell in a Cell and the TLC that sandwich it, and that's the key reason.
That's an excellent point, and I couldn't think of a better way to illustrate the fact that maybe Survivor Series, just by the nature of what it is now, the way wrestling television has become over the years, has maybe outgrown the Survivor Series concept, than this week's Raw, which I'm very happy with. We're recording this right afterwards, where they actually did a 5-on-5 Survivor Series match to build up this year's Survivor Series.
Marvellous.
Of course you do.
Why wouldn't you?
So on that note, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everybody for all the feedback. I want to thank everybody for listening this far. Again, next week we're going to be returning with our show talking about Jump the Shark moments in wrestling history. So leave your feedback on the forums, leave it on the Facebook page, if you will. Moments in wrestling history that either turned you off a promotion or turned friends of yours off a promotion, or just general comments on well-known Jump the Shark moments. Get your Katie Vick and Billy and Chuck Wedding comments in now. So that's going to be a fun one next week. We will be back. So... For G. John Chase.
I love you, Tom Campbell.
For Carl Jones.
Again, thanks to that gagging order, I cannot say that Jimmy Snooker is guilty.
And for Q&O Rock.
Remember, folks, follow me at Wrestling Prophet on Twitter, and you can get my live updates on The Raw in Manchester next week, depending on how drunk I get.
I'm Leo Rock, and we are out of here. See you next week.